The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz hosts a radio show in Seattle, and he has, as always, the details for us exclusively.
Jason Rantz, our Seattle guy, is with us now.
Jason Rantz, always great to have you in focus. Thank you.
Hey, Jason, I think you're all right, and thanks for being on the show.
An update on what's happening in your Pacific Northwest.
One Seattle city council member is livid. The city just de facto legalized drugs. She'll explain what happened. The Washington State Republican Party chairman, Caleb Heimlich, explains why he's saying goodbye to the role. Plus, our top doctor in the nation, the Surgeon General, says social media could pose a risk to kids. And now, why is it that Seattle Public Schools is excited about that news? We'll tell you this hour of the Jason Rantz Show. So, let's get into it.
The monologue.
We take you to the wonderful wide world of politics, not sports, although politics can be a pretty rough sport when you think about it. Certainly going to be the case, I think, for Mike Pence, who announced that he is running for president. He said he was happy to do the work as VP, but I guess not happy enough to stay in Trump's good graces and then run with him again.
And as your vice president, I was proud to stand by President Donald Trump every single day when we made America great again. Everything I am, everything I ever will be, I owe to my family, the people of this country, and to Almighty God.
Nice guy. I know some people want to pretend that he is, I've heard him called a rhino, which is the most absurd position I think I've ever heard about any politician to consider Mike Pence a quote-unquote rhino, simply because you don't like that he didn't go along with the wishes of the president on January 6th is patently absurd. You don't have to like him as a candidate. You don't have to say he has a shot in the world because he does not. He is not going to be president. But let's stop pretending he's not a conservative. He very clearly is. But the question becomes, why is he running? He knows there's about 30% of the base. They're 100% behind former President Trump, and they don't like him. They see him as a sellout. He knows he is going up against Ron DeSantis, who is very popular within the conservative movement. He's going up against all of these other candidates. Why is Mike Pence making the decision to run? Now, while I think he thinks he could eventually win, maybe, sort of, kind of, we'll see. Or at least he's convinced himself that. I'm willing to bet, whether it's conscious or subconscious, he is running because he wants to clear the record, the historical record of who he is as an individual. He does not want to be tarred by January 6th. He doesn't want to be tarred by his association with Donald Trump. And we know as a matter of fact, because historians tend to be very, very far to the left, that that's what they're going to do with Donald Trump. And by stepping up and saying, I'm going to challenge the former president, he is telling folks in the media, he's telling folks who will write the history books that, no, I don't stand by him, not with what he did. That's what he is doing here, I think. I think that's the intent. Let me clear up my legacy, or at least try to do some damage control. It's, of course, not going to be enough from the perspective of a historian. They will continue to write what they're going to write. They will take positions that they're going to take. That's what they do. But I do think this is his chance, at least in the short term, to try to do some damage control for his legacy. In fairness, I don't know if he would even be a big part of the history books. I think it would be so singularly focused on Trump, because that's what Trump does best, right? He takes all the energy out of the room. The focus is on Donald Trump. That is one of his skills, that he can get on stage with 12 other candidates potentially, and the focus will be completely on him. 90% of it will be on him. And he knows how to work that room. And so I imagine that the history books will kind of forget Mike Pence. And he is forgettable in the sense of his personality is not over the top. It's not aggressive. It's very buttoned up. It's very low key. He's not someone that people, at least I don't think, get excited about. The reason why he worked as a running mate for Trump was because Trump was so aggressive, so over the top, so brash, right? And Mike Pence was there to say, we also have an adult here. We have the quote-unquote politician, the guy who knows the systems, who knows the institutions, who knows how to make sure that the personality in chief doesn't totally take over. Oh, and by the way, all the religious folks who traditionally vote Republican, who maybe you're feeling a little uncomfortable with the brashness of Donald Trump, well, if I'm here, you can trust him. That was why he was chosen. But no one got excited about him. And no one's going to get excited here. I mean, even when he said he was going to be president, let's listen to the response.
I've long believed that to whom much is given, much will be required. That's why today, before God and my family, I'm announcing that I'm running for president of the United States.
Oh, and we didn't have the That's not your fault. I mean, it is, but I feel bad because I yelled at you.
It was a bad cut at the end on their part.
There was not this. There was obviously cheers, right, because he's got his own people there. But it wasn't nuts. It wasn't over the top. This is, I'll have to reenact it because you didn't pull the audio. Here's, you be Mike Pence and say, before God and family, I'm running.
Okay, before God and my family, I'm
a little bit, no, too much personality. Bring it down, yeah.
Sorry, even for me?
Okay.
Yeah. Wow. I've never heard that before.
The only time.
Before God and my country and my family, I would like to announce that I am running for president of the United States of America.
Shoot, now? Yeah!
Visit MikePence.com.
It didn't feel exciting. It didn't. And part of it is they're so staged, all of these things. Including Donald Trump's one. I wasn't actually all that impressed when he announced again because it just felt like he was giving another speech. And we knew it was coming because it was really just another speech, but we knew it was going to include his announcement. And he started really, really early. I don't know. I'm kind of just – I want a debate. That's all I want. Let's just get everyone on the stage, the ones who at least qualify. Chris Christie might not. Mike Pence might not. Get the ones who qualify. Let's get Trump versus DeSantis. Let's throw in Doug Burgum just because I think it's funny. He thinks he can be president. I'm trying to figure out why he's running. And let's just figure this all out.
The interview.
Caleb Heimlich, the pride of Puyallup, the chair of the Washington State Republican Party, is calling it quits. He is moving on. He says it's time to move on. But why? What's going on? Joining me on the line is Caleb Heimlich. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jason.
I note that you made your announcement not long after our last interview, which, number one, makes me wonder if I pushed you out. And number two, if I didn't and you knew about it beforehand, why didn't you tell me then? But I'll give you the opportunity now. So why the decision?
I mean, it was the interview. It was too many hard questions, as you're known to do, and I couldn't take it anymore. No, I mean, the real reason is I've been at the state Republican Party now for 12 and a half years. I mean, when I started, I was 25. I was single. I had a lot more hair. And now 12 years later, I've gotten married. I have three kids. And it got to the point where kind of the demands of the job, in addition to the two-hour commute up and two-hour commute back, it was just not sustainable for a family. And I decided to take a different position where I could be a little bit more present as they're growing up, still making a difference, still staying in the fight for a better country and more freedom and opportunity for all, but just in a different capacity. And so that opportunity to take a different role presented itself. And as I evaluated it, I felt like the party is in a good position for a transition. This is an okay time to get a new person in at our meeting in August, get their feet wet, and then really hit the ground running going into next year's big cycle. But the party's got money in the bank. We've got a good staff. And so I felt like it was a good time as any to pass the baton. This has been an absolute honor and a privilege. I've enjoyed all the people I've gotten to meet, all the people I've gotten to talk to, but it is it's a challenging position. Senator Steve Daines from Montana, when I met him, said, "This is the worst job in politics." And, that may be true at times. It's also very rewarding at times, but, I think I've been in the role longer than anybody since Jennifer Dunn in the 80s. And so I felt like now's as good a time as any to pass the baton.
You say taking on a different role. What is that different role?
So we haven't been publicly announcing it yet, but it'll be at a national grassroots organization. I'll be working in some other states, doing a little bit of work in Washington as well, but supporting candidates, getting good people to run, again, continuing to advocate for freedom, for opportunity, kind of for conservative causes. So I'm excited about that. And we can circle back after the August meeting and chat about that if you want.
Do you anticipate getting involved in the next the vote for the next head of the party?
I don't really. I mean, obviously, I will be there at the meeting in Olympia. I think it's imperative that it's the committee, the state committee, the 117 people making their selection. Certainly, I'll give advice if people want to ask my opinion. I think there's some things to consider in what can allow a state party chair to be successful. I think obviously being able to fundraise is important. I think the temperament required of the role, where you're dealing with a lot of different people that don't always disagree and feel very passionately about what they want to be done and how they want it done. I think it takes a certain type of person to be able to handle all of that. And so I'm happy to share those insights from not only my time as chairman, but also my time as executive director and political director. But I also think it's important that I'm not kind of tipping the scale. So we'll see who decides to step forward, and we'll happily share the contact information for the state committee with them. And then I'll let the committee make their decision.
And, you know, obviously there are people out there who also want to weigh in. Do they, the people who are listening, who maybe they like Jim Walsh? We spoke with him yesterday. Maybe they like a future person who's throwing their hat in the ring. How do they get involved? Is it just connecting with their neighborhood precinct office? Like, how does that work?
Yeah, the best way to get involved would be to go to their county party, because the people that vote on our state committee are the county chair and then the committee man and committee woman. And so depending on which county you live in, if it's King County, I like look up the King County folks. There's legislative districts that meet once a month. You could go to a district meeting and share your concern or opinion there. And so, yeah, that's the process. I mean, this is really a bottom-up. PCOs are elected. They vote for their county chair, committee man, committee woman. And then those three individuals make up our state committee, and we'll be casting the vote at that meeting in August for the next chair to serve out the remainder of the term until January of 2025.
Well, I am glad that you're still staying involved in politics. Maybe you'll run for a position at some point in the future. Caleb Heimlich, thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me, Jason. And that might be in the cards. We'll see what happens down the road.
We'll see. That is Caleb Heimlich. Now this.
The interview.
Another crazy day in the world of cable news. The anointed one, post Jeffrey Zucker over at CNN. Chris Licht is out. He is out. He's only served there for about 10, maybe 12 minutes, as well as a lot of his high-level close executives. They're all out of jobs. Joining me on the line to discuss exactly what went wrong is Curtis Houck, our friend from Newsbusters. Welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you, my friend.
So Chris Licht didn't last long. He not only had to deal with the public sort of attacks from some of his employees, or at least the public-facing attacks, because they leaked really quickly. But I can't imagine that behind the scenes he wasn't being undermined the entire time because he dared to say CNN shouldn't be overtly partisan.
Yeah, there's really two things about this. You know, Chris Licht being undermined is one thing. You know, I don't even think undermined is even appropriate to describe what he was. He was run out of town by a woke mob. A mob that was still like Barack Obama media like devotion on the part of CNN employees to Jeff Zucker. They worshipped him. I mean, he was Daddy Jeff to them. Like I don't think people realize they loved being told what to do and loved being told what to do by Jeff Zucker. Jeff Zucker, you know, was a infamous micromanager. You know, he had a million other responsibilities with other like Time Warner properties, Warner Media properties, but he would choose to be in the control room and he would be on all these morning editorial calls saying we need to hammer this and hammer that with Donald Trump and, you know, say all these horrible things about conservatives, and he would empower hosts to be as viscerally, you know, insane as possible. And Chris Licht was never really given the opportunity because he came in and said, wait a second, you know, can we like cover more than one story a day? Can we like actually have Republicans on and not actually yell at them? You know, like, can we just start with that? And can you guys all admit that CNN's brand has taken a hit in the last few years? And we should probably try and fix that. And of course, none of that was acceptable to these, you know, children at CNN, because that's what they were. And that's how they behaved. Where Chris went wrong was he didn't clean house. Mm-hmm. Because he didn't really clean house, he kind of messed around the edges. He got rid of Brian Stelter and John Harwood and Chris Liza. But because you kept a lot of these Zucker loyalists around who weren't going to be convinced, you allowed them to leak and undermine you. And because you weren't a micromanager, they were allowed to largely continue doing what they've been doing.
Yeah, it was. I think that is a great observation. He had a bad strategy going in, because if you're taking over and you've got a toxic environment of folks who are loyal to the last guy and will never be loyal to you, and frankly are loyal to a partisan cause rather than what's in the best interest of a brand, you're setting yourself up for failure by keeping them in those positions. And I say they're more loyal to a brand because they have to realize that CNN is not doing well. The ratings are incredibly low. They have had to cut significant amount of costs because of that. And it doesn't matter. Let's say they go back to a Jeff Zucker-like CEO moving forward. Well, guess what? If they go back to where they were under Jeff Zucker, they're still going to do poorly, and that's not sustainable.
It's not, you know. And the thing about the Tim Alberta profile, which, by the way, you know, was – I have a really long piece up at Newsbusters about how Chris Licht was naive, you know, people should read. But one of the things was in the Tim Alberta piece, which my main point on that is don't talk to – this is like a big billboard to like not talk to journalists, because especially national journalists, they will sell out their mom in the name of a scoop or a story. A lot of these people will. Chris Licht, you know, he was asked about, like, what is journalism basically to you? And he said journalism is being trusted and everyone has an agenda trying to shape events or shape thought, but there has to be a source of absolute truth. And people have to look at and go, they have no agenda other than the truth. Yeah, that's really hard to do, but he's trying to say we shouldn't have everything in an 11, having to comment on every Trump story. And, you know, another thing that upset people at CNN in that profile was he said, we don't even know how many people actually died from COVID, because people are listed as having died from COVID, but they died from all kinds of other things. Mm-hmm. They were in the hospital for all sorts of other reasons. And that like is a little subhead of things that people were upset about, that he dared speak out against the Church of COVID on that, which I think is interesting that I don't think enough people have really mentioned, that mm-hmm. he went hard after that in the lab leak. But where Licht went wrong, Jason, too, is he kept Don Lemon, for goodness sake. Don't talk about changing culture and then say, oh, we're going to put Don Lemon in the morning show mm-hmm. and then just put a blindfold on and throw darts at the wall for picking the other two co-hosts. I mean, that just wasn't going to work. And the profile really is instructive in revealing that even in rehearsals, Licht didn't like what Lemon was doing, his fashion choices, which everybody mocked when the show actually went to air, and his commentaries and his spy comments. Licht would tell him this, and Lemon would just kind of stick up a middle finger and be like, screw you.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the proof that, like, dude, you need to have the stones to actually make these changes. Don't just talk about culture, implement it.
Exactly. Last quick question for you. What do you think comes next? What kind of CEO do they go for? Do they go for another Chris Licht who does in fact clean house, or do they go for another Jeff Zucker who will embrace the crazy?
Well, that's a tough question because CNN has lost value and Discovery, that bought Warner Brothers, is shaking their head. And that's a question for David Zaslav. You know, he also wants this vision. So does he want to continue implementing this change? And key stakeholder John Malone, does he continue wanting this change? Because if the answer is yes, it's going to be really difficult to get somebody to take that job right now. I think that job is really hard right now. So I see the interim group staying for an indefinite period of time. And these are all like longtime CNN execs that survived, you know, Zucker being fired. So these are longtime CNNers who I guess will just stay the course and just allow people to kind of do whatever they want to do. But as the presidential campaign ramps up, if they don't get a guy in place or a change of mission or define their mission, I think we're just going to go back to seeing what we saw in 2020 and 2016, which is good for us, but not really good for America.
No, it's not. If you want to learn more about where Curtis Houck stands and how the world of cable is reacting, go to newsbusters.org. Curtis, thank you so much.
No problem, my friend.
You're listening to The Jason Rantz Show.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Here to react, Seattle talk radio host Jason Rantz.
And the rise of soft on crime laws and policies have made it worse.
Our man in the Pacific Northwest, Jason Rantz, is on that.
And you keep on bringing these extraordinary stories from Seattle. It's amazing.
Long form.
We've been talking about it all week. And of course, yesterday we learned that thanks to one vote, Andrew Lewis, the Seattle City Council decided to opt out of criminalizing drugs to the point where Seattle City Attorney Ann Davison would actually be able to enforce the law and be more consistent with what was decided at the state level. Activists said that this was criminalizing addiction, and they've been pushing back pretty hard. And unfortunately, we're now in a position where, let's be just blunt, more people are going to die as a result. Joining me on the line is someone who's deeply disappointed. She co-sponsored the ordinance that would have given the power to the Seattle City Attorney to prosecute. Joining me is Councilmember Sarah Nelson. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jason.
How surprised were you by the outcome?
Well, I was shocked that we have that we did not conform Seattle Municipal Code to state law. So, and I'm framing it that way because I think that people need to realize that this was a routine measure that we were going to do. We always, after legislative sessions, modify our municipal code to conform with state changes in the state criminal code. So that is why I'm providing that. But I do have to say that I was surprised that downtown's representative has abandoned downtown by voting no on this.
I guess my question is, why are you surprised? Because, you know, I looked at this and I suppose I was thinking to myself, okay, maybe Andrew Lewis, who's up for re-election, will make this decision because he knows people actually are paying attention and he knows the consequences if he doesn't. But at the same time, he's still an ideologue, like so many other folks on the council. And with respect to Dan Strauss, a council member who voted with you on this, he only did this for political purposes. I don't think he believes it. You're on this council. You know the makeup of it ideologically.
Well, I guess hope springs eternal, right? Here's the thing. There was overwhelming community support to voting yes on this. I don't know what input. I'm not going to try to get into the minds of my colleagues, Jason. I can only say that I felt pretty good going into that vote. I was surprised and shocked. And what it means is that, as you mentioned in your intro, that effectively the decriminalization of deadly drugs since the Blake decision is going to continue. So we've got status quo, no change from here on out.
And I've heard the very disingenuous argument coming from folks on the other side of this, basically saying it's clearly, in fact, I think it was Lisa Herbold who called you out, claiming that this is not at all decriminalizing. The King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office still can handle this, except, number one, they're not handling it in previous years by choice. In this year, maybe it's a little bit of a mix, but it's certainly not on their agenda because of the backlog that they have. And the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office, Lisa Mannion, the prosecutor, said she endorsed this bill.
Not only that, she said, we can't take those cases.
Yeah.
Please pass this bill. It makes more sense. That is what the city attorney's office is set up to do. Please vote yes on this legislation. That is either willful ignorance or something worse. My point is that The county prosecutor is not going to prosecute these cases. It falls to the city attorney to prosecute, to file charges, et cetera, for misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors per state law. And now we will not be doing so.
So what happens next? I mean, do we just wait to see how many more people die on the streets of Seattle?
You know, I am still trying to process the magnitude of what happened yesterday to even think about next steps. I am not giving up on my city. I'm not giving up on people that desperately need some incentive to get into treatment so that they can make good decisions about their future. I'm not giving up on the small business owners who are writing to me daily to say that their staff are at risk when they try to confront people who are smoking fentanyl in their doorways and please would the city do something. And I'm not giving up on the parents that are worried about people, you know, doing illegal drugs in parks, et cetera. So next steps TBD, but I just want folks to know that we take an oath to protect the health, safety, and well-being of our constituents. And we fouled, I believe, yesterday a little bit on that.
Not a little bit. I think a lot, right?
Okay,
I mean,
I'm trying to be nice.
I know you are. Stop being nice. Because, look, at the end of the day, this is – I'm not being hyperbolic here. This is going to cost more people their lives. And I get the point coming from folks on the left who say we don't want to just, quote-unquote, criminalize addiction and throw addicts in jail. But this was never about throwing addicts in jail unless that is the only thing that will prevent them from continuing this deadly addiction and committing the crimes to help feed that addiction. The intent has always been and will always be putting people into treatment. But at some point, you do have to have a stick with that carrot because they don't like the carrots and they need that stick.
You're absolutely right. And here's my fantasy scenario. People are smoking fentanyl at the bus stop on 3rd and Pike. Third and Pike, and an officer sees it and comes up and basically is able to say, sir, that is now illegal in Seattle. Please don't do that. And if you here's a diversion program that we can get you into instead. It provides an opportunity for a potentially productive interaction with people that desperately need help. That is, you know, and when I keep saying we need a tool to incentivize treatment and, you know, and getting people into diversion programs that we are spending millions on already. That's what I mean. It's another carrot. And the stick of jail isn't going to happen because they're not even accepting misdemeanor bookings for anything but DUI and domestic violence.
Yeah. And the addicts know that. Frankly, criminals know this too. Criminal addicts definitely know this and they're taking advantage. We're talking with Sarah Nelson, Seattle City Council member. Are we ready for All-Star Week or the All-Star Game and the week going into it with what's been going on and continues to go on downtown into Pioneer Square and Soto?
I have not had my briefing yet, but I would say that there is a lot of work to do. I know if you're asking me a real question, Jason, I know that there is work going on in the background to improve lighting, et cetera. There's a big cleanup event coming up, I think, on the June 23rd and 24th. But like I said, the status quo prevails. We have done nothing to provide any kind of incentive for change here. So it remains to be seen what memories and images people will take back home of downtown Seattle going forward.
Yeah, and isn't the truth of this all that there's only one of two options? You leave the homeless in the area or you move them, right? Isn't that basically the only two options there? So are you thinking the city will just sweep for a few days just for the MLB All-Star Week, bring them into the International District, somewhere else nearby? Is that what you think will happen?
You know, you're getting out of my area of – I'm honestly saying that I do not know the extent to which the Unified Care Team is involved in making sure that people are housed and sheltered that are presently living in this area.
I think we all agree, though. I think you agree on this part. There's so many downtown right now. There's no way that we're going to get all of them into shelter, right? I mean, there's no way that they're going to be able to do that kind of job.
That could very well be the case. And I do not know what the plan is.
Is the truth of all of this that it's just purely political and the only way we're going to see any kind of change is by just making better decisions on who we put into office? I mean, we've got council seats up for grabs in this upcoming election. If we make the right decisions, couldn't we just start turning things around pretty quickly?
Yes. That is my answer. Too many people are relying on ideology, dogma, et cetera, and it does come down to making better informed decisions. And I'm going to stop talking on that one right now because I'm walking a fine line. We know that I cannot talk about electoral politics.
Sure, but this is more about the process after being elected. Are you concerned about the direction?
Yes, I am concerned about the direction because I want to make sure that anybody occupying an office on the second floor is actually talking to their constituents.
Yep.
And is hearing those concerns that I hear every day as a citywide council member from across the city. And how can one make decisions without taking into account what's really going on out there?
Yeah.
And so people better be coming to work, seeing what's going on downtown, and I mean in person,
mm-hmm.
and going to community meetings, reading their own email, talking to people. That is what we are elected to do.
Just real quickly, because I know you're always in the office. How often are your colleagues there?
I know that when they have actual council meetings, they have to be present.
Is that about it? I mean, when you're walking the halls today, did you bump into anyone?
No, I have not yet.
Yeah. I think that's rather telling. Councilmember Sarah Nelson, go ahead.
I do want to say something here about what happened yesterday. You know, Ann Davison and Alex Peterson and I put forward legislation after the state legislature failed to act. We put forward legislation, a simple misdemeanor on public use, prohibiting public use, on April 27th. And what the chair of public safety said was, I'm not going to hear any legislation until the state acts to fix, for a permanent fix to the Blake decision. And they didn't want a patchwork approach, jurisdiction by jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And so we listened to them. And we updated our legislation once the legislature had acted. And what do we end up with? A patchwork approach. Now we have the biggest city in the state that has a different regulatory structure than all the cities around us. What do you think that is going to do?
Yeah. And by the way, that also means we're just definitely going to see a continuation of a stream of drugs getting onto our streets. And it doesn't just stay in Seattle. It's going to get into Greater King County. It's going to get into Snohomish County and Pierce County. We know that as a matter of fact, and there's no escaping it. And that's the unfortunate reality. I'll give you the last word on this.
I am disappointed that we abandon our duty to make sure that people are safe and healthy in the city of Seattle. And I'm not giving up.
I'm glad you're not. I'm glad you're one of the two council members who are consistent on all of this. I'll give Deborah Juarez credit for making the right decision yesterday. And again, even though I don't think he did it for the right reasons, I'll give Dan Strauss credit for making the right decision. I hope that the future will be a little bit better for you as far as who your colleagues end up becoming. But that's a conversation for another day. Sarah Nelson, council member, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Jason Rant Show.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle Talk Radio host Jason Rants. Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rants is in focus now.
Jason Rants, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
When we get stories about social media and its impact on children, I always kind of have a conflicting view internally. I struggle to find a hard and fast position as to where I stand because generally, number one, that's good for radio, but generally that's just how I think. I either think something's good or bad. I see it oftentimes in black and white. Even when there are complex and nuanced conversations, I can at least see a clear path. I might understand the other side and disagree, but I see a clear path to where I want to go. But when I see a story like this one from King 5 about how the nation's top doctor says social media could pose a risk to kids, and they think that it's going to strengthen the lawsuit by Seattle Public Schools against the social media companies. I find myself confusing myself as to where I stand, because on the one hand, I look at this, and we'll get into the comments made in a second, but on the one hand, I say, okay, I certainly understand that social media can be deeply dangerous for children, for their mental well-being. 100%, not only does the data back that up, but I think it's dangerous for adults in many cases, so I certainly think it's dangerous for kids. But on the other hand, when I see a lawsuit from Seattle Public Schools and they want to just basically take money from social media apps and websites to fill their budget, and that's the only reason why they're suing, I want to instinctively push back at that and say, well, you can do a lot to help these kids on your own, right? You can mitigate the impacts of social media by blocking them from being accessed on campus, by educating kids and parents about what they can do to ensure that they are not falling victim to what social media can offer, can create. You've got one student who spoke with King 5 who admits, look, I've become addicted to social media.
I did build a little bit more of a dependence on that, and kind of like, I guess as people talk about, it's like serotonin, just kind of picking up your phone, it's like, ooh, there's a new message, right? Like, what's this, right? And that then becomes your sole like center of attention.
So you've got Vivek Murthy, the Surgeon General, Dr. Murthy, who put out some guidance, new guidance, in the form of a statement about the dangers of social media. And he points out that with adolescence and childhood representing a critical stage in brain development that can make young people more vulnerable to harms from social media, the Surgeon General is issuing a call for urgent action by policymakers, technology companies, researchers, families, and young people alike to gain a better understanding of the full impact of social media use, maximize the benefits and minimize the harms of social media platforms, and create safer, healthier online environments. Quote, the most common question parents ask me is social media safe for kids? The answer is that we don't have enough evidence to say it's safe. And in fact, there's growing evidence that social media use is associated with harm to young people's mental health. Children are exposed to harmful content on social media, ranging from violent sexual content to bullying and harassment. And for too many children, social media use is compromising their sleep and valuable in-person time with family and friends. Seattle Public School District looks at that and says, yes, this is only going to help our case. In fact, the attorney, Felicia Craik, told King 5 that, you know, part of this case hinges on the fact that we believe that the problems that are arising in adolescent from using social media is intentional.
Defendants have engineered their platforms and made design choices to maximize user engagement at the expense of youth mental health.
Now, I don't know if they can prove that particular point. I certainly believe that social media companies have created a product that is intended to get people to come back and stay with them. That's business. That's entertainment. That's what movies do. That's what Netflix does. Hulu. Amazon Prime Video. That's what they do. They want you to come back. There's no doubt about that. But at the same time, I don't know if that's intended in the sense that they claim to hurt people. I don't know if they believe that it hurts people actively. Now, maybe they've seen some of the studies, obviously, and I think it was the Wall Street Journal that did that big write-up talking about studies that they had access to and saw the results of, but maybe they just disagreed. Maybe they didn't think that the study was as valid as others. It just, for me at least, I find it hard to believe that this is intentional in hurting kids. That's just my view. I just find it hard to believe that they would do this intentionally. But I certainly know where I stand when it comes to Seattle Public Schools. If a parent wants to come forward and sue, okay, where does SPS get off to do this for kids when Seattle Public Schools is also a reason why kids are struggling emotionally? You are pushing upon them issues, politics, partisan politics that are confusing, that are demeaning. When you tell kids that the white students in class have this unearned privilege and they're responsible for white supremacy, I think that probably has a negative impact on their mental health. I certainly know that when the teachers' unions kept kids out of school, it hurt their mental health along with their academics. So it seems to me that you're trying to dismiss all the harm that you've done individually at the school district level. Also that you can get some extra money coming from Snapchat and Facebook and Instagram and TikTok and whomever. Because you see dwindling enrollment, which means a smaller budget. You need to make that money up. And so you're looking at social media companies to basically give you some funding for that budget that's light. Now, Craik, this lawyer, says the goal of the lawsuit is to fix the problems.
We'll explain to the court ultimately what it's going to take to fix the problem, what sorts of funding and programs are necessary.
Funding. We're going to tell you how much money to give us. We're going to need more money. Give us more money. It's always about the money. It's always about the money. Speaking of which, I'll take some of your money. If you want to purchase my book, pre-order What's Killing America, it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Walmart.com. Go wherever it is you get your books online. And please, I would encourage you to become a pre-order fan. It's the Jason Rant Show.